The legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
It's often been said that banking is simply another word for robbery in all sorts of ways. Or is that tax rises? I don't know. But it does seem as though banking corruption is very much on the rise. And to talk us through some of his findings with respect to that, we're delighted to welcome the lead financial investigator who effectively helped to bring three of Iceland's largest banks to justice after uncovering the world's largest stock market abuse scandal ever to be prosecuted. That's the wonderful Jared Biebler. How are you, Jared?
Thanks. I'm very well, Alex. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate that.
Well, it's always important to try and get at whatever the truth happens to be. And we do seem to live in a world where corporate industries, whether it's big pharma, whether it's big tech, whether it's big banking, is proving problematic. Share with us the findings behind, obviously, your latest awesome text that we're speaking about today.
Thanks. It's hard to overstate this. This was effectively the entire stock market of a country manipulated for up to 10 years was what we found. So in Iceland, we had three big banks collapse in 2008, which I think some of your listeners are probably familiar with. What we discovered when we had a really unique opportunity to dig into those banks, they were like frozen in time, which we never get out in the world. And things are always moving. But these banks had collapsed, so we could go in and look at what they were doing. And what came out, which we kind of couldn't believe, was they had been buying up their own shares for many years on the open market to set the price where they wanted it. And on the back of those share buys, they were able to borrow much, much more from the international debt markets. But then later, UK and Dutch savers came to the rescue to continue their growth. And when they collapsed, it was terrible. All, especially for us in Iceland, but all around the world, for anybody who had put money.
The book, of course, is entitled Iceland's Secret, the Untold Story of the World's Biggest Con. Were you shocked by your findings, or did you kind of always have a suspicion that this kind of underhand behavior was going on?
I had worked at one of these banks briefly as an asset manager, and I actually resigned a couple of days before the crash. I didn't like the small things that I saw as an asset manager, but I was never prepared for, and nor did I believe my eyes when we first started digging into the shares manipulation that we found. It was beyond the pale.
Again, allowing for that, is it just a case of we sleepwalk into this, that actually customers really don't mind, or if it's brushed under the proverbial carpet or whatever, people aren't all that interested, really?
Yeah, I think, again, Iceland was unique in the sense that it really devastated our economy when the banks went down. The stock market lost 97% of its value in a short time. And actually, we were close to a complete freeze of payments and a complete freeze of even, you know, maybe even your MasterCard Visa wouldn't work. People, the unemployment rate quintupled, and there wasn't actually the UK enforced terrorist legislation against Iceland to freeze payments into the country. And the supermarket shelves were going bare. People were losing their houses and their cars. And so I think we had a unique situation where the public really demanded some accountability. But I think you're right in the sense that, yeah, sleepwalking is often more the approach.
As you said, Iceland's three largest national banks all collapsed. More than 30 criminal cases were referred to the special prosecutor of Iceland. Was justice served in the end, or is it just a case of, well, they're living happily in the Seychelles somewhere?
I'm proud of what we did, because I think in Iceland we did set the example that you could go after complicated crimes against CEOs of banks, and they would end up serving at least some prison time. There wasn't very much; it was maybe a couple of years, and they would be out in a few months. But still, I think that was very important, and I think it was a good example of something that we could do more broadly in the world. But I think a really important point for me here is that in no country, including Iceland, no country are the incentives for regulators to go after such things bigger than the incentives for people in the financial sector to commit crimes. So regulators tend to be paid less, and many of them dream of going into bank jobs. So when they come across something, there's not much pushing them to be hard in their jobs. Whereas on the other side, bankers who cut, you know, cut corners, they can take home millions of pounds in bonuses, right? So I think the way we've set up this system, it's kind of inevitable that we would have big collapses. And what I'm worried about is that the Iceland thing was just a preview of a much bigger financial collapse that could be coming for all of us.
Well, that, of course, is my next question, Jared, because we're living in a world where cryptocurrency is being talked about as a regular ongoing way of investing. There are all sorts of other aspects. Even before we start talking about the bounce back after the pandemic, there are issues and concerns with respect to the finances and where things are going. Do you feel as though actually this is the beginning of the end of capitalism?
That's a big question. I really, you know, I was a bright-eyed kid in the 90s. I always read The Economist, and I wanted to believe in, I actually believed in pure markets and pure capitalism. I think there is a way that capitalism can succeed, but we've gone so far in this idea that markets are somehow divine creations that can't be monitored. We've forgotten that we create markets. We set up the rules, even down to things of the opening and closing time, the tick size, and on and on. We create and we structure, and we need to regulate them so that they can do their nice work for us. So I don't think it's the end of capitalism, but I think we need to make some changes.
Vigilance seems to be the watchword in terms of making sure that things are there. People listening to this who might well say, oh, well, that was Iceland. It could never actually happen here. Is that naive? Is that a case of actually it doesn't really matter whether you happen to be dealing with Beijing or Sydney, Australia or London, England or New York? These things can obviously impact the globe.
Yeah, I think so. I think with Iceland, we had a nice sort of a test case or case study where we could see the corruption, and we could see these type of crimes pretty clearly. I actually think when you read the book, you get to the end and you might be a little bit unsettled, because you could see how it could also be going on in a much bigger scale and in bigger places. I will say that I've worked in several countries now in financial regulation, and everything I've seen points to some level of corruption being endemic in the world markets.
And looking at that whole essence of corruption, I mean, the perpetration of multi-billion pound financial schemes, people never being prosecuted because of their mafia-like links. I mean, it's obviously just to the mill in terms of conspiracy theorists who would say, well, there we are, there you have it. It's the Bilderberg theory. That's what it's all about. We don't stand a chance.
I don't think you need to be a starry-eyed or wild-eyed conspiracy theorist to see, again, the way we've incentivized regulators versus the way we've incentivized our financiers would point to, hey, this is gonna go bad. There's nothing to get. Nobody, or even within a bank, someone in compliance, there's nothing pushing that person to really do a great job and stop transactions, because they're going to get probably fired for that. But if we step back and look at this big story from yesterday, the Pandora Papers, we can actually see that the beneficiaries of a lot of financial misengineering are politicians and very powerful people. They have created also international schemes for offshore centers and so on, where money can be hidden. And so it's really, I think, to change this really needs to start with the public becoming more engaged in these issues.
You mentioned the Pandora Papers, and I was actually going to go on to that, because clearly Pandora's box, as classicists will be aware of, is where all the evils of the world effectively were emerged, apart, I believe, from Hope, which effectively was the last thing that was left in the box from that point of view. Do you feel actually that that is, again, something which, yes, it's causing a bit of a scandal at present and people will be concerned, but come a couple of weeks from now, people will still actually sort of motor on in their own way?
Yeah, that's probably right. Unfortunately, I think the point I would make, which I don't see made often in the press around issues like the Panama Papers or the Pandora Papers, is that ultimately it's the willingness of people in London, for example, or New York, to do business with companies that are set up in dodgy offshore jurisdictions that makes them viable, and that's something we don't hear enough about. I mean, my niece is 9 years old. She could write me a piece of paper that says I own a company, and I could take that, you know, to a bank and they would laugh at me, right? But if a company in the British Virgin Islands, not to pick on them, but that's one of the main jurisdictions. If a company in that jurisdiction, if a law office gives me that same piece of paper, I can now go to a London bank and open a trading account in that company's name. And I think that's the problem. The offshore finance, it isn't really offshore. It's always onshore. The offshore is just the smoke where the smoke screen is built.
Has technology made it easier for corruption to become endemic? Or is it just a case of, well, we kind of have the same level for years, even when we did actually used to have paper stocks and shares and such like?
Well, actually, so that's a two-edged sword. Yes, it can make it easier to set things up. You know, you have much quicker lines of communication than we used to have. But on the other hand, I think it's also hopeful that things like this huge international consortium of journalists could come together and bring out something like the Pandora Papers. That never could have happened 30 years ago, I think. So I'm hopeful, actually, that technology is in the end a democratizing force. But let's see.
The Fourth Estate, of course, of journalism was originally set up to actually monitor the activities and goings on, and also to provide information so people in the early trading aspects could find out what was happening in different parts of the world. We go back to the South Sea bubble and other sort of areas as well. Do you think journalism still has a critical part to play in terms of holding banking corporations and banking practices to account?
Yes, absolutely. I will share with you a quote. It's actually on the blog for the on the website for the book Iceland Secret. It's an anonymous quote from a senior banker here in Zurich, and she said that a blog that we have that kind of talks about the goings on. It's called Inside Parada Plots. She said that blog is our only regulator. Now that's a bit extreme, but I think the power of journalism to hold power to account cannot be overstated. And what concerns me a bit is that, there's been great developments in independent journalism. Now people can create YouTube channels and do excellent research and put things out that way. That's very powerful and positive for the democratization of information. However, now you have this issue of YouTube, Facebook, and so on, able to censor opinions, and they actually have the ultimate say in what goes on those channels. So that's a bit maybe going the other way.
It was something I was going to mention, because clearly we do have a whole new range of billionaires at work, the Jeff Bezos, the Mark Zuckerbergs, and so on and so forth. Are they rewriting the rules to suit themselves? Is it just a case of, well, it's the old line of the mafia back in the day, as long as you've got a smart lawyer, you can do anything?
Yeah, that's definitely a big concern, especially as regards ownership of the media, coming back to that. I think we're kind of in a gilded age that's worse than the first gilded age. I don't know how this ends. I don't see how it ends well.
So advice, Jared, for people listening to this who might be sort of very worried about whether they should even trust banks in any way, shape or form, what kind of suggestions would you have? Simply use the mattress and actually store funds under there?
I think my bigger message would be, look, you can probably keep your money safely in a bank. That's fine. But in terms of trusting markets, I would be do your research, do your homework. If you're buying a stock fund or if you're buying individual shares, something like this, do your research and be skeptical.
Iceland's Secret, The Untold Story of the World's Biggest Con, is available now from Harriman House UK, presumably available online as well.
Yep, it even has an audiobook read by me. So if you like my voice, you can you can hear more of it.
Fantastic. Jared, it's been fantastic and fascinating just getting an insight into your fabulous work and research with us. Are you working on something else at present? I mean, is it a case of it's all hush-hush, I can't say anything?
I've been doing a bit of work on the sustainable finance area. There's a great opportunity now for what's called greenwashing, which is setting up, you know, dirty investments and coloring them green. So that's kind of the newest area of maybe manipulation.
Well, certainly with COP26 around the corner, that could be another sort of aspect which could be addressed and talked about. But for the moment, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the Midweek Drive today? Has it been okay for you?
It's been fantastic. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, the next critical question is, can we look forward to inviting you back again? Will you come back and speak more of your findings in terms of banking corruption and beyond?
That would be a pleasure.
And we say congratulations to J.D. Kirk, ace Scottish crime writer, author of An Isolate Incident, and also nominated for the 2021 Kindle Storyteller Award, the shortlist. So congratulations, J.D. Well done.
Thank you very much. It was a real honour to be on the shortlist, and very unexpected as well, I have to say.
Well, talent will always rise to the top, a bit like cream, so that's always important. So share with us, in terms of, you were born and raised in Fort William in the Highlands. You're a graphic narrative writer as well. You've written thriller, mystery and crime stories as well from that point of view. So is crime were you influenced by Cracker as a child?
I used to watch Cracker, Robbie Coltrane, with my mum, actually, way back when. Yeah, so I did love Cracker. I also loved Hamish Macbeth as well, which was Robert Carlyle. It was set up in the Highlands. So I was watching, I suppose, a lot of crime, because my mum was really into crime fiction and all, with books and TV and all that stuff. So she kind of dragged me into it, I suppose. But I was actually a children's author for 10 years or so. And before I had an idea for a crime novel that I kind of one day wanted to write, but I was writing funny books for children, so I never quite got around to it until 2019, when I published my first DCI Jack Logan novel using Kindle Direct Publishing.
And again, interesting you mentioned that, because the lines of Colder Than the Grave, that's another DCI Jack Logan novel that was actually there. I should have known things were going too well. Genuinely happy for the first time in years. Jack has almost fooled himself into believing that the world is a decent place. Fatal last words. I mean, what is it? Yeah. Do you like just putting your protagonists through stresses and strains, JD?
Oh, well, absolutely, yeah. Make them as miserable as humanly possible, I say. I think it's, that's what all good fiction is about. Nobody wants to read lovely people having happy times, because it's not interesting. You know, everyone wants to live that life, but you don't want to read about it. What you want to read about is people that you care about being put in miserable situations. And that's what I've done with the DCI Logan series, is I've built up this kind of family of detectives almost. They're a kind of dysfunctional family, and I just do terrible things to them on a regular basis, and thoroughly enjoy every moment of it.
I won't ask, is that predicated on the work of Nicola Sturgeon at the Scottish Parliament? Because it would be not appropriate this to do a step
yes,
away
no
from
comment.
It. And Lord knows we have enough challenges with the chap who's actually in 10 Downing Street, this side of the border. So who knows where things are going for that. The beauty of the Kindle Storyteller Award, of course, is it genuinely crosses borders, crosses boundaries, and crosses genres. I mean, there are so many sort of different styles of genres in this particular category. I mean, surely everybody's a winner. I mean, were you tempted by anything else, or was it a case of, I've always fancied a sort of nice romance, basically?
No, I'm not. My wife would tell you I'm probably not going to be the best romance author in the world, really. It's not something I'm drawn towards. But yeah, you're right. I think everyone is a winner on the shortlist. I mean, speaking from my experience, I was writing for traditional publishers for 10 years, and I had some great experiences with that. But with traditional publishing, you're always answerable to an editor and a marketing team and all that sort of thing. With Kindle Direct Publishing, I've been able to just take the stories I want to write and put them out there for readers to find. So creatively, I'm more fulfilled than I've been in my entire writing career, really. And I'm fortunate enough that the books are resonating with readers and readers are enjoying them.
In terms of the creativity aspect, I mean, Scotland is known for all manner of wonderful creations. We've got Val McDermott in terms of the crime fiction scenario. You could ask, arguably say, Grant Morrison in terms of graphic narratives and lines with respect to that. And that's before we even think about the likes of Robbie Burns and Robert Louis Stevenson and all of the areas within that. In terms of being influenced and your inspiration, is it just a case of, well, I just look around the Highlands and it's all there, basically, or do you go further afield?
Well, this series, the DCI Logan series, is set exclusively in the Highlands. Or there were a couple of kind of trips to Glasgow, but it's mostly set in the Highlands. Essentially that, which is laziness, because I live in the Highlands and it meant I had to do very little research. I could just go for a nice walk and go, oh, I could find a dead body there, or, you know, there could be a car chase along here or whatever. So I just get to wander around the Highlands, usually in the rain, because it rains a lot. So,
but you either got that, or you got the midges in summer. So, I mean, that's all.
Yeah, absolutely. Goes. Yeah, yeah. So you're tormented either by rain or midges. And both those things appear quite regularly in the DCI Logan series. The protagonist of it, DCI Logan himself, has moved up from Glasgow. So he's not perhaps as used to the midges and the rain as some of the other characters in the series are.
So let's talk about an isolate incident. As you mentioned, it features your wonderful creation, DCI Jack Logan. How much can you give away in a kind of tease the reader or prospective reader line about what we're going to see when they actually get this from Kindle?
Yeah, so An Isolated Incident is the 11th book in the series. It involves a home invasion gone wrong in Glencoe, which is kind of 10 miles down the road from me. And it leads DCI Logan down to Glasgow at one point because one of the victims is one half of a 1980s Scottish comedy act called Neeps and Tatties. And who didn't actually exist, I should stress. I haven't killed off anyone in real life. A fictional...
You must have been tempted to incorporate the Crankies somewhere along the line.
The Crankies get a mention. I was going to say, I'd imagine it's the only book on the shortlist where the Crankies get a mention.
Fan-dabby-dozy, JD. That has to be in your winning speech, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I'll get the double thumbs up and the wee red cap. So it's again set in the Highlands. It features the most of the same characters who've been in the series so far, and it has lots of twists and turns.
Sounds absolutely awesome, and again, well worth accessing. We talked about, obviously, the advantages of Kindle in terms of publications and so on. This year, it's the fifth year, record number of submissions terms of the whole sort of sequence that we've got there. Would you advise any budding writer? I'm thinking about writers who might be doing a creative writing course at present, or they might be doing other things, or they're just writing. What advice would you actually have as clearly a winner, even having just been shortlisted?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the publishing side of it, I think we're at a real kind of crossroads in the publishing industry at the moment. There is the traditional method of finding an agent and then finding a publisher, and that can take several months, several years, and may never happen. We also have KDP, which allowed me to write the stories that I wanted to write and immediately make those available to readers all across the world, and it costs nothing to do. So if you're thinking about it, then I would say you've got nothing to lose. You can take that book. If you decide in a month's time that you want to get that book published by a traditional publisher, then you can just take it off KDP and do that. So I encourage any author who's interested in giving it a try to give it a try, because you've got nothing to lose apart from the few minutes it takes to upload your file.
And that, of course, is one of the key strengths of the whole process, that you can have that direct connection with your prospective audience.
Absolutely. Which, hundreds of millions of readers around the world. Yeah.
And arguably, if you have the kind of editorial process that's in place as well, maybe that selection can sometimes mean that the actual narrative is filtered. And filtered narratives can be great, but at least this is literally from your keyboard to the eyes and minds of the public.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's the thing with traditional publishing that I encountered, is that there are, as well as an editor, there are several other people involved in the decision-making processes. So a sales and marketing team who might have no editorial experience might chip in and say, well, can we put a unicorn in that story? Because unicorns are really big at the moment. And if you don't want to put a unicorn in that story, you kind of find yourself in a situation where either you have to do it or your book might not get published. So why I'm feeling more kind of creatively happy than I've felt in years is that there's nobody telling me what I can and can't do. All it hinges on is whether the readers are going to enjoy it or not. So I could write anything and put it on Kindle, but if the readers don't like it, then I've wasted nothing apart from a few minutes. But I've been fortunate enough that I have been able to find quite a lot of really invested readers.
as we said, it's the 21st of October when the winning title will be finally announced. I do not envy the judging panel for this, even though Claire Balding's on there as well.
Yeah,
I'm not sure where Claire Balding actually stands on unicorns. I mean, horses, I know she's a big fan.
I'd quite like to see her standing on a unicorn. That'd be an impressive impressive.
It could be another case for DCI Jack Logan.
Yeah.
The case of the BBC announcer and the unicorn or something along those lines.
That's maybe Amazon could arrange it for the ceremony. She could ride in on the back of a unicorn. But
yeah, JD, two final questions. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been good for you?
It has, actually, yeah. I don't get to Zoom very often because normally I just sit in a room making stuff up. So it's nice to see another human face occasionally. So thanks
for that. Well, it's the joy of wonderful visuals on radio. So the next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the very near future? Whatever your result, whether you end up winning the £20,000 prize or whatever, will you come back and talk to us?
Absolutely. I'll come back and talk anytime at all, Alex.
And finally, just to mention that your website, jdkirk.com, presumably the best place to actually go to find out more details.
Yep. Best place to find me, yep. And for information on the Storyteller Prize, it's amazon.co.uk/storyteller.
Breast cancer is certainly something which is not an amusing matter, but certainly it's how we actually cope with the whole issues, which are very much the fore here. And it's interesting that a whole new boob portal has actually just opened up. And to talk around the whole notion of boob portals and indeed how this is connecting with breast cancer care and indeed health, etc., we're delighted to welcome Dr. Frankie Jackson-Spence. How are you, Frankie?
Hello, thank you for having me on.
Excellent. So talk us through this whole notion of the self-checkout Copperfield boob portal.
So October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and I partnered with Avon and Copperfield to encourage women to check their breasts. So it is this notion that we are responsible for our own bodies and we need to be regularly checking our breasts at least once a month to get to know our own normal, so that if we notice any changes or any potential signs of breast cancer, that women get checked out early. And the boob portal is this educational hub set up by Avon, which has lots of information and educational content about how to check your breasts, when you should be doing it, what are the signs to look out for, and what to do if you do find something. So it's a really useful tool for women.
And it's really quite shocking to find that according to the World Health Organization, there were 2.3 million women diagnosed with breast cancer. And indeed, 685,000 deaths globally in 2020. Presumably, lots of those deaths could have been prevented, again, if early identification had been sought.
Absolutely. Breast cancer is the most common cancer in the UK. And with early detection and diagnosis, and if you can pick it up at an early stage, it can be curable. So knowing your body and knowing the signs to spot early on can make a massive difference to outcomes.
Mm. Again, as you noted, effectively, it's a case of ensuring that checks are carried out regularly and indeed self-checks are there. How would you kind of address issues of when people do feel concerned? Because obviously it can be very stressful if women find that they might sort of find something slightly unusual. What steps should they take?
Yeah, so I completely understand that a lot of women are afraid of looking because they're afraid they might find something. But what I really want to emphasise is that even if something is not normal and you know something's not quite right, it's important to go to the doctor. And even out of 9 out of 10 cases that are referred to the breast clinic turn out not to be cancer. So, you know, it's probably nothing. And that's why I really want to ease some anxieties, that if something's not quite right, it's probably nothing, but 1 in 10 will be cancer. So a small number will be something that needs intervention. We really want to encourage women to just be empowered to take, you know, ownership of their body. When something's not right, go to the doctor and not put it off.
During the pandemic, of course, the whole notion of Avon calling was restricted, obviously, to online scenarios. But in terms of the 5 million Avon representatives across over 50 countries, apparently they're being offered access to a training module again, which is designed to obviously enhance the awareness of Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are just trying to educate as many women as possible and get them talking about this so they know the signs to look out for. And, you know, there isn't a right or wrong way to check your breast. So a little bit of knowledge is really is power in this situation.
And where would you recommend people should actually go to find out where the areas we've been talking about today can be further analysed? Where is the Boob portal?
So the Boob portal is on Avon's website, which is available worldwide, and it has links with Copperfield's self-checkout tool, which can guide you through a self-breath checking 5 minutes or so. And there's lots of information on there, even from people who have been through this journey together themselves or a family member.
Dr. Frankie Jackson-Spence, huge thanks. Keep on saving lives and keep on keeping on.
Thank you for having me.
Improved mental health, improved work-life balances, improved productivity, improved motivation, and improved fitness levels. Those are just some of the positive effects that people are expecting to experience as they begin to travel back to the work environment. But are those expectations being built up, and can they be achieved? Or is it a case of maybe we should actually use the train to actually just engage with the whole process of how we can get that work-life balance together? Well, we're delighted to welcome from the University of Central Lancashire the awesome neuroscientist extraordinaire, Dr. Joseph Devlin, back to the program again. How are you, Joseph?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me on, Alex.
Well, as I say, I'm speaking to you from my office at the University of Lincoln. I've had that journey in. I didn't travel by train, though. And I don't know. Do you think that people's expectations are being built up, that as more and more people return back to the office environment? I mean, those key things there, mental health, work-life balance, productivity, that's a significant number of things that people are expecting to get better.
I think we don't have a magic bullet here, but I do think that there are a lot of benefits that people will see. They just won't be transformational. They'll be sort of incremental. Health is, you know, an obvious one in the sense that if all we're doing is commuting from our kitchen to our bedroom, you know, every day, there's a lot of opportunity to overeat, to sort of graze all day long, and also not to physically move. Whereas if you're walking to the rail station, you know, walking to work, getting in, out at lunch and all that, there's actually quite a bit more physical activity. And that comes with a number of physical benefits, but also mental health benefits in terms of just feeling better about yourself, reducing stress levels, things like that. So I think that, you know, it's not like night and day, but there's definitely going to be clear benefits. And I think people will generally experience them very clearly.
Hybrid working is clearly the buzzword that is likely to, I would have thought, be impacting most of us. And as an example, I could say that here I am in my office. I've proven that. I've changed the background. And yet, what am I faced with today? A series of online meetings, including a Microsoft Teams meeting online with other colleagues, some of whom are at work, some of whom obviously aren't on campus, some of whom are at home, etc. Is that something which we're going to have to get used to as a matter of course, with masks to the ready, of course, should anybody else actually come into the room so everything else is sorted out?
I think for the medium term, you're right. We are going to be looking at that kind of hybrid environment and possibly in the long term. But one of the things that's very clear from sort of the psychology and the neuroscience is that actual physical interactions with other people are different than these kind of face-to-face, team, Zoom, et cetera. And you actually get real benefits from interacting in person. So among the sort of mental health things, socialization is an important aspect, and people, again, have stronger sense of well-being. They actually get benefits to your immune system, remarkably. So actually interacting with other people, you're going to be less likely to catch the season's flu, let alone pandemic, you know, Mach 10 or whatever we're on. So there are real, you know, concrete benefits to being in the work environment, interacting with other coworkers in person, as well as the inevitable online components.
You mentioned obviously the pandemic there. A few weeks from now, of course, COP26, climate change, the environment. One of the things about traveling into work via the rail system or the rail network is it can be seen as very much good for the environment in a whole range of ways. So would you like to share with us, Joseph, a little bit more about how the rail industry is maybe actually going to be fulfilling that brief of ensuring that commute to work doesn't become an endurance test to be mastered or endured, but one that actually can be advantageous to our general well-being?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because there was a very famous study on life satisfaction done about 2004, and people rated their commute as the least satisfying part of their life, even below going to work itself. So it is something that people often find stressful, but what's noticeable is that's almost always in the context of driving. Whereas when you're on a train, it's a different situation in many ways. One is just that you actually have this sort of opportunity to have some quality me time, right? So you don't have the distractions, the competing environment of driving a car. You can actually focus on what you're doing. And that gives you a better sense of autonomy, in the sense that you can pick what's valuable to you, whether that's reading a book or listening to an audiobook or sitting there staring out the window and enjoying the scenery. Whatever it is that's useful to you allows you to focus your efforts without the sort of competing demands, and it reduces the stress, and it's been shown to improve productivity when you actually get into work. Interestingly, there's an advantage to going home too, which is if you use that as a boundary and can shut off from work, people report feeling better at home, being able to focus more on their family, they sleep better at night, and again, remarkably, they tend to be more productive the next day at work.
It's interesting you mentioned the whole notion of the journey, because when I used to commute into the London area, the underground, the London Tube, it was anything other than a nice, relaxing experience. We would have sort of sardines, all range of things there. I say bring on the driverless cars, personally. That would be a step forward, but maybe we don't want to go there. I mean, as technology improves, as it enhances, as it delivers different ways of, as we've said, hybrid working, do you think you will see, as we project ahead over the next 5 years, for instance, many more cases where people will say, actually, sometimes working from home, as long as connectivity is good, et cetera, is advantageous. Other times, actually having connectivity at work or in a working environment can, as we say, also have benefits in terms of, I won't say the illusory water cooler moment, but I do think that's one of those mythologies that has grown up over the years where you think, did it really exist when you gathered around the water cooler to talk about the latest sort of activity that was there? I'm not so sure. But in terms of that, is it the balance that's ultimately at the heart of this whole essence?
I think so. It seems clear to me that there's going to be a fundamental shift, and it will be something that individuals are looking at and being much more proactive in deciding whether or not today is a more productive home day or a more productive office day. I mean, I think that water cooler moments, I know what you mean by that. But the reality is, when you're in the office or you're on the workplace, you do run into your colleagues, and you do sometimes result in sort of the same kind of banal conversations, whereas sometimes they lead to more interesting topics. And it's, you know, there's no guarantee you're going to get one or the other. But just that social interaction actually offers sort of an increase in your autonomic nervous system. Your brain actually responds to other colleagues face to face in a way that we don't otherwise. And there's some benefits to that, because it helps reduce stress, and it just makes people feel a little bit more relaxed and have a higher sense of well-being than they would otherwise.
Although, Joseph, it has to be said, I've cultivated over the last 18 months the frozen Zoom face to, I think, you know, levels of true perfection, really. You know, I think when you do encounter something, you should actually just stop like that, really, and just continue ever onwards. Let's move on to the joy of this partnership between, obviously, UCL and the National Rail team, because there is actually an incentive that's actually being provided here in terms of how people can actually travel and book with confidence. Would you like to just share with us what they can actually do from that perspective?
Well, again, this my side is mostly the science. My understanding here is that the rail industry have created this partnership with FutureLearn, which is an opportunity to, you know, utilize that time on the train to do something that you want to learn, like a new language or a new skill or something. Mm-hmm. And it's just an opportunity to really focus in on the things that the individual finds valuable for themselves, and hopefully make it a very productive time that's as stress reduced as possible.
And you can find out more details about that by going to nationalrail.co.uk/commuter. Got to ask the question, Joseph, when you commute into UCL, do you take the train? Do you actually cycle? Do you decide to, what's the route that you take?
I actually go by train when I go into work. So this is very relevant to me as well.
And were you surprised by any of the findings, or did you think, well, 77% of hybrid workers planning to return to their workplaces, that's over three quarters, that's high?
To be honest, I was surprised at those kind of figures. And at some level, I'm delighted because I'm keen to be in the office a little bit more. So I'm glad to see that this isn't just me just being an odd fellow. It actually seems to be relatively normal, and I'm glad to hear it.
Well, there you go. Two final questions to wrap up with. We like to say the customer service ones. I think you know what they are. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed this today. Thank you very much, Alex.
Well, then the next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again? Will you come back to the program?
I would love to. Anytime.
Professor Joseph Devlin, neuroscientist extraordinaire. Huge thanks. And keep on investigating our working habits.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Infant colic. It's something which certainly you may well have suffered from. You may well know somebody who is suffering from it. But the fact of the matter is that a baby's persistent, inconsolable crying can actually make more than a quarter of parents feel that they're doing something wrong. This is all found in a recent study which demonstrates the concerns with respect to colic. And to talk about this particular aspect, and indeed maybe provide some consoling words of wisdom, we're delighted to welcome parenting expert and indeed mum of four. That's the wonderful Ruth Davis. How are you, Ruth?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Colic, Ruth, in terms of the sequence, I mean, we hear a great deal about it, and people can obviously panic, especially new parents, when they feel as though their child will just not show crying, will not stop crying at all.
Yeah, and it's really panic-inducing when a baby is crying at any point, especially when it's your first baby. But colic is quite different. It's caused often by a temporary lactose intolerance. And the main signs associated with colic are, like you said, episodes of excessive and inconsolable crying when they otherwise appear to be perfectly healthy. With my children, it would start in the evenings and it would go on for hours. Now, if you don't know what colic is, you would automatically think that your baby was poorly. And that's what's the frightening thing about it. It affects one in five babies, so it's incredibly common. But obviously, with the distress for both baby and parent, that's when you need to look at ways to alleviate it.
Now, you also run the Rock and Roller Baby blog. Is this something which you set up as a result of your own experiences of colic in the family? Or was it just a case of, well, we'll just add this into the whole mix?
So it wasn't born specifically from my experiences with colic, but it was born from my experiences as a new parent, which obviously everything as a new parent is frightening. And I wrote about my experience from when I had my first daughter 11 years ago. And obviously colic was included in that because she suffered terribly. And being my first child, I didn't know what colic was. And it wasn't until I talked to other friends, family and my GP that I worked out probably wasn't doing something wrong, because that's another thing. 13% of parents surveyed said that they feel like they're failing, and that is how it makes you feel when your baby is crying and you can't stop it.
What advice then, Ruth, do you actually have to somebody who might be listening to this, or they know people who actually have got a young baby and so on, and they're struggling to deal with colic in the home environment?
Okay, well, so identifying that your baby has colic is quite easy to do. And coleaf.co.uk have lots of information on how you can identify that your baby is suffering with colic on their website, as well as hints for how to soothe the condition, including using Coleaf infant drops, which is what my GP and my friends advised me to do, and which is what made such a difference, like turning a switch. We had our happy baby back and we were able to relax in the evenings and enjoy her.
I think one of the most important relief tips that I think you've also provided, Ruth, is the notion of staying calm and trusting instincts. Many people perhaps don't trust their instincts and as a result, perhaps panic unnecessarily, would you say?
Yeah, of course, especially with new parents, but with any baby. I've just had my fourth and I still panicked about her when she got colic. And, you know, it's, I think, inbuilt in parents to worry, but very worth remembering that if you stay calm, the baby will feel calmer as a result, because it will mirror your emotions. They're so in tune with you.
Congratulations on your fourth child, obviously. Talk us through some of the other tips that you'd suggest could be quite useful in terms of ways to actually work through. I mean, the good routine aspect, I think, is particularly interesting.
Yeah, so I'm not a routine parent as a rule, but when it comes to the evening bed and bath time routine, I do stick to that, and I do think it helps with colic. Obviously, if it's caused by a temporary lactose intolerance, then that's digestive. And I like to do baby massage on my babies in the evening after they've had their bath, and that definitely contributes alongside using the drops.
And colic drops, exactly what are they? I mean, they're presumably not drops of colic that you're actually saying, here, take these, it'll make you better.
So Coleef infant drops are very gentle. You mix them with the milk. So if you're breastfeeding like I do, then you mix with a spoon of breast milk, and you can feed it that way, or in a syringe, or you can just put it in your bottle feed. And what it does is it gently breaks down the glucose, which will settle the tummy and alleviate those symptoms, which are, you know, the inconsolable crying, the legs drawing up, the red face, the anger, and often back arching. That's another real telltale sign that they're suffering with colic.
And trying out different feeding positions, that's one which I suppose is quite interesting. But presumably, as you're dealing with continually evolving and changing internal parts and organs as well, that might well have an impact.
Yes, it can definitely help. And obviously, I've breastfed 4 children, and so I'm quite seasoned at it. But I think the first time I was breastfeeding, that's really difficult. And so if you ask for advice from friends, your doctor, your midwife, they'll be able to help show you different techniques and different ways of holding the baby so that you can feed them in different positions.
And clearly that is another key aspect as well, that if you do actually need to, then seeking advice from your GP or indeed family or friends can actually be useful as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with lockdown, it's been really tricky for parents to access that help. So websites like coleef.co.uk have become invaluable. They have all of the information on them if you aren't in a position where you can go and seek friends' advice in person or speak to your GP. However, saying that, we're coming out of lockdown, and speaking to your GP is always a really good thing to do. My GPs have always said to me, I'd rather see a parent that I just have to reassure than a parent with a really sick baby. So they would never mind you going, even if there's nothing wrong.
Yeah, very important. Now, just to confirm that, we mentioned a couple of times already, it's coleef.co.uk as opposed to coleef.com?
That's right, coleef.co.uk, and it's Coleef Infant Drops.
Excellent. C-O-L-I-E-F. In terms of the spelling, which will actually take you through the whole thing. Ruth, it's been fascinating actually working through the process there. With 4 little children, I mean, is it a case of you've seen everything there needs to be seen and all's well with the world? Or are you always sort of expecting a new experience every day with one of them?
Oh, you're always expecting a new experience every day, for sure. For sure.
There you go. Ruth Davis, parenting expert and, of course, the coordinator of the Rock and Roller Baby Blog. Just out of interest, was it designed to actually deal with Rockabye Baby, or were you talking about the wonderful classic Bill Haley rock and roll era? What was the sort of concept behind the name?
My husband is a musician, so the name of my website is born from that.
Well, that makes perfect sense then. The Rock and Roller Baby Blog, Ruth Davis. We salute you. Take care now.
Thank you.
Ah, the joys of the staycation. You might just have actually had a staycation, so on. But what's this? Another new word for our vocabulary, the workcation. Could it be that actually there is a way in which we can combine life skills, balance, and indeed the experience and joy of actually working in different parts of the world? Well, maybe there could well be. So let's actually talk to 2 fabulous individuals who are certainly geared up to actually talk about this. First of all, travel writer extraordinaire, let's face it, the I column will be a lot less without the wonderful world of Simon Calder. How are you, Simon?
Well, never had an intro like that. Thank you very much. Most people simply say cheap and available.
No, never, never. You've already sort of carved your reputation over in past sessions with us. And indeed, the chief executive officer of the Ultimate Travel Club. I'll say again, the Ultimate Travel Club, UTC, Brett Norman. How are you, Brett?
Hello, I'm very good, thank you.
Brett, talk us through some of the findings of this little survey that was out. 4 out of 5 UK adults have stated that if they were to work away from home, they'd also likely combine it with a holiday, hence the word workcation.
Absolutely. And the research that we've commissioned has surprised us in terms of, I think if we'd have gone back 2 years ago, the amount of people who would have considered collaborating with work and holidays at the same time would not be as high as it is today. But certainly life during the pandemic has we've all been able to learn to work from home, and savvy employers now recognise that actually productivity is still as good, if not better, than working in the office. And that's, I think, translates into the results that we've got from this survey, which employees now can consider themselves that working and travelling at the same time is something that appeals to them.
Yeah, indeed, almost two-thirds of British workers effectively claim that if their employer allowed, they would consider working remotely, not only in the United Kingdom, but also abroad. I was intrigued by the destinations. I mean, we had clearly Las Vegas, Mount Kilimanjaro and Disneyland, but apparently just ahead of Disneyland is Europe, which is nice. I mean, I always thought Disneyland was like, I always knew it was a separate entity unto itself, but, you know, Europe is up there as well, topping the list.
Absolutely. We've got some very exotic destinations on that list, but also I think the majority of British workers consider Europe as being their number one spot, I think for a number of reasons. Obviously, working in roughly the same time zone, being very easy to get back to the UK if needed. And of course, you know, very good infrastructure in terms of Wi-Fi capability. But also, you know, from a holiday perspective, I think Europe offers us so much on our doorstep. From city breaks to beach to mountains, there's a wealth to do on our doorstep. But it's not just about Europe. You know, I think certainly we've learned in the last year that the staycation has become certainly something that is here to stay, I think. And whether or not we want to take ourselves away for a week in Spain or a week in the Cotswolds, I think there's definitely a broad range that people can do now.
Simon, you, as we always suspected you were a pioneer in this whole field, which is, you know, clearly you were workcationing long before it was even a considered word in the vocabulary. So is this something where you're sort of finally saying, yeah, the rest of the world is catching up with me? Once again, Calder leads the way.
No, not at all, because I've just made a kind of career out of being on holiday pretending to work. But this is actually serious people doing serious work. And it is really extraordinary what we've seen during the pandemic in terms of the way generally a lot of people who are lucky enough to be able to have, as it were, portable careers have been commuting maybe from the bedroom to the kitchen and working all day. And they're enlightened employers realize that actually, whereas working from home used to be a euphemism for going down the pub, they are actually being very, very productive. They're doing great things. They're quite possibly having a better work-life balance because they've got rid of the two-hour commute or whatever. And from all points of view, it is a good, therapeutic, productive lifestyle. And so this is why the research from Ultimate Travel Club is just fantastic, in that it shows the degree of appetite that people have. Two-thirds of working people in the UK, even higher for millennials, saying, yeah, please let me have some of this. And I celebrate the fact that we will be able, I hope, to be on those online calls on Zoom or Teams or whatever, with a fantastic backdrop, which isn't a green screen. It is actually the Mediterranean or some great European city, or maybe, according to some people in the survey, Kilimanjaro in Tanzania.
There's nothing wrong with a green screen. I just switched it on from the point of view of a radio piece, just to actually see you're where you happen to be in terms of life and various other bits and pieces. Let's turn back to the Ultimate Travel Club, because that sounds very, very exciting, just in terms of it's the ultimate. Were you particularly sort of interested in the findings that millennials are keen to work from home, to actually take on board this notion of saying, yeah, I quite fancy actually having my Teams meeting from, Florida?
Well, absolutely. And millennials clearly have got probably more flexibility than couples with teenagers, although, you know, three quarters of couples with teenagers would love to be able to spend more time, you know, particularly family holidays, using the school holidays to the full advantage, decamping to the south of France or Spain maybe for 4 or 5 weeks and getting good work-life balance. But the research did surprise us. And clearly, the new proposition that we're bringing to the UK, the UK's first travel subscription, which allows members to book travel without any markups, us taking any commission, so effectively at cost price. It's quite important for travellers. If they're going to be travelling more frequently for longer, then value becomes very, very important for them. And we believe that our model, by stripping out those costs, and for a small monthly membership of £19 a month, members will be able to save hundreds, if not thousands, of pounds a year on their travel, and that links back nicely to how we believe that travellers will spring back from this pandemic and want to go and explore the world for the next couple of years.
Simon, do you think this means the end of the cult of presenteeism, that actually companies will actually say, if we don't see you in the office and we don't physically see you by your desk, you're not there?
Look, I think it is fantastic that enlightened employers now realise that it's results that count. And so, therefore, it really doesn't matter where your member of staff is, what time zone they're in. If they are delivering the goods, helping your business, then I think that's something we should all celebrate. And of course, after 18 months of this terrible pandemic, an escape is just going to be such benefit to everybody's emotional health. And of course, if you're a happier bunny, then you are probably going to be working happier, working better for your employer, and everyone is going to benefit.
And Brett, strategically, was this in place before the pandemic, or did you actually have within the Ultimate Travel Club some wonderful soothsayers and foretellers of the future who said, yes, that's when you should introduce this, that's when humanity needs it?
Well, obviously, I'm glad that the travel industry has gone through a torrid time over the last 2 years, and I'm glad that we weren't in a position where we'd launch this prior to the pandemic. But I think certainly it's a perfect opportunity for those people who are looking to start to explore the world again, and to be able to make advantage of some great savings and pass back and make travel much more affordable for more people.
And would ultimatetravelclub.com be the place to go to find out further details?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I absolutely would be. And for any of your listeners at the moment, welcoming new members can take a 14-day free trial, take a look around and explore their heart's content.
Well, as you can see, I prefer the background of a nice sort of beach-like environment, because it's so much nicer than, shall we say, Lincoln in the autumn. Or maybe not. I don't know. Just a thought there. Two final questions for both of you, of course. Let's start off with Simon. Simon, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
It's absolutely fantastic. I've been as productive as I think I can be. I defer to Brett, who is the most productive person, I think, right now, starting a new travel business just as we're coming out of the horrible gloom of the COVID crisis. I can guarantee that he is working remotely, but he's working very well. If you're one of his team, he honestly is.
Exciting times, Brett. So allowing for the fact that, who knows, you may be in Kilimanjaro, you might be in Disneyland. We don't know. Has it been good for you?
Absolutely. And I must admit, there's nothing like meeting in person, but the reality of the green screen, I think, is here to stay.
So that was, we're connecting. I can see both of your elbows, which is nice. So that's great. You can see very slowly. Yeah, there's a hand retrieving. That's wonderful. Simon Calder, travel expert and journalist extraordinaire. And of course, Brett Norman, chief executive officer of the Ultimate Travel Club. Huge thanks and happy voyages, gentlemen.